Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 days a week for your listening and amygdala-tickling pleasure from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. We're also Fukushima irradiated as well as fluoridated. And everybody's got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to help the economy, which, because we're in charge of pretty much nothing, doesn't really matter one iota to the global economy, which is basically soon to collapse and wash us away in a tiny little island chain tidal wave fashion that we've all seen on TV too many times. Today, we have a guest for 2 hours who has such eclectic background, interests, and skill sets that I don't think we're going to stay on the one topic, and nor would I want to. I'd like to take drips and drabs from this person because of his long history, essentially, of deep research, authoring books, tattooing, spirituality, mushrooms, cults, was even a member of a cult. He has a PhD, and you can check out his website, if you dare, at clinicalanthropology.com. He is Dr. John Rush. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's my pleasure and honor. Now, the Jesus and mushrooms, this is a topic that I'd like to get into, but if there's any other prefacing or background to perhaps yourself that you might want to give listeners who are unaware of you, what would you say?
Well, I think I would begin by telling you I'm an anthropologist. And, of course, that's a big buzzword these days. A lot of people, watch Bones on TV and so on. I'm a clinical anthropologist, which means I use anthropological concepts within clinical settings. And this is where hypnosis comes in, marriage and family communication therapy comes in, the use of herbs and tinctures, if you will, in terms of healing. So that's what a clinical anthropology is. Now, with this background, I also know about systems and how they work and how they fall apart. For example, why big systems like governments fall apart. It's very easy to understand why they do. And I think Jan Irving, in the interview that you had with him, attempted to explain a little bit of that. And I really enjoyed that interview, by the way. Along with that, I manage a feral cat community. We have on the property right now about 17 cats on about an acre of land. The reason they can stay here without killing each other and so on, they're all fixed, they get fed. But there's a very big herb garden on the property. I bring students and staff over here from the college at which I teach, and I tell them about the herbs. I tell them about the substances used within these quote-unquote religious rituals. Along with that, again, the substances that are in my garden, nothing illegal, certainly, but I have many of the substances that are used within the these what are called religions. And the students get a better idea as to what's really going on within these systems. Also interested in ancient aliens and all that silliness that's going on. There's a very good YouTube site out there that kind of debunks all this that Jan Irving introduced me to the other day, so you might want to go and look at it. It's called Ancient Aliens Debunked. Very good show. What else can I say? I'm interested in paleoanthropology, which means I'm interested in the behavior of our ancient ancestors, how they made a living. I'm interested in paleopathology, how people got sick. And when you understand what happened to our ancient ancestors before we got into agriculture, you can understand why we're all sick. It's the way we eat and the way that we're supposed to eat, according to the USDA. You know, we're supposed to have our proteins and our carbohydrates and fats at the same meal. Well, that'll make you sick. Of course, the USDA is not interested in health. There's no money in it. And so they promote this this storyline, if you will, that we get sick because of germs and bad genes. But most illness is from cellular toxicity and malnutrition. What else? Oh, one of the other things has to do with what I'll call is the disease of language. How people use language, but in a different way than Jan Irving was talking about. The way we put words together creates a reality. For example, most people, most languages promote the idea of emotional irresponsibility by the way they use a language. This has led to this business here in the Middle East of blaming that guy who did the video on all their ills and so on and so forth. That is a clear case of emotional irresponsibility. In the Arab world, they believe that women give men erections. That's a total expression of emotional irresponsibility, and you can see where it leads. Emotional irresponsibility leads to violence. At any rate, that gives you a little bit of a background. Where do you want to start?
Well, there's often the things that are most offensive to people is what many choose to leave for last. I choose to do it first. Let's go for the Jesus mushroom.
Okay. My interest in the use of mind-altering substances within what we'll call religion, let's get this straight, what a religion is. A religion, according to the original definition, is one person's piety toward the supernatural world. It has nothing to do with what you wear, what you eat, what you worship, going to church, paying money, has nothing whatsoever to do with that. These traditions that were sold these days as religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, but these are not religions. These are political systems. They are designed to control people. That's simply all they are. Now, Hinduism and Buddhism come a little bit closer to this religious idea because it is the individual who is, you know, going internal and interacting and so on and so forth. But the word religion was one person's piety, and it can only be that way, really, when you think about it. So let's get that. That's what, you know, we need to get that straight. The second thing here is that as I got more and more into the literature and anthropology, as I matured as a graduate student, I kept bumping into all this information on the use of substances, whether it's peyote or cannabis or whatever. And it get, all this stuff kind of gets hidden in these journals. In 1970, we encounter John Allegro in his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I didn't know what to think of it because I just didn't have enough. I'd been a graduate student for a couple of years, and I didn't know what to think about it. But in 2001, in the summer of 2001, going through the cathedrals in Europe, and then eventually coming back to the United States and running around the cathedrals in San Francisco and so on. There's just mushrooms all over the place if you know what to look for. As I got further and further into this and referred back to Allegro's work, it's quite obvious that Jesus was an experience. He was not a real person, as people would assume. And the art points this out very, very clearly once you get into it. One of the things with the art is that the mushroom is a, at least in my opinion, is a representation of a generalization or a generic for a host of mind-altering substances that were used in the early cults out of which came Christianity. They were all using something in some way to get to the other side. Now, taking it from there and understanding how cults work, as I, you know, I joined one for 3 years, finally was asked to leave because I was told I was there for the wrong reason, which is an interesting way to tell you to get out.
The wrong reason, meaning, you're not willing to submit to our mind control. You're bad.
I, as a matter of fact, I went out of my way to destroy the cult once they kicked me out of it because I could see what it was doing to people. I mean, just look at Tom Cruise. Look what Scientology's done to him. I mean, he, in my professional opinion, he's a nutcase. Fortunately for him, he can play all these different roles and kind of avoid all that. But I don't think he has a role to play within, you know, normal society anymore. Because of the way that they brainwash people. It's essentially what they do.
Have you noticed that with when people can become inordinately famous or powerful, they get so eccentric as to borderline on the complete insanity, and yet people love them for it?
Yeah, they go beyond the bounds of the myth. That's the insanity that we see. The myth is what keeps us, quote, quote, normal, you know, that type of thing. They've gone beyond the bounds of the myth. And one of the reasons that they do this is I think that they, playing these various roles, really lose contact with who they are. Very few of these people really can live a normal life, not only because of the roles they play, but because they're hounded by publicity people and all that. And so you can see where they go a little bit nutty. They have to hang around with other people like them. Really, it's hard to hang around with the average person. How are you going to do that? It's going to be difficult. And so you hang around with people that are like you, and it's like being on a psychiatric ward.
Could I ask? I had this. When you're an actor, you have to somehow get rid of that character after you finish playing them, sort of thing. Otherwise, part of that character kind of melds onto you, doesn't it?
It sure does.
I remember when I was in drama school, I think I might have been 16, and I just played a very violent, aggressive father, and it was a really kind of harrowing sort of play about drug addiction and things like that. And our teacher had got us to get a piece of our costumes each and put them in a box and say goodbye to that character, and I didn't understand what she meant about that or why she was doing it until you've just kind of brought this up now. I was thinking about it yesterday and I didn't know why I was remembering that thing that happened so long ago.
Telepathy. I probably got into your brainwave somehow. This idea of role confusion is really, really what it is. In order to play that role effectively, you've got to get into it. And without a closing ritual, it's hard to get out of it. It's like a soldier. You go to boot camp, and they have to convert your secular psychology to that of a warrior. And this is what boot camp is all. That's why they're so brutal. And then you go in, you get in war, and you're in combat or whatever it is, and they have to perform a ritual to let you back in. But, you know, they've been deficient in doing this. And this ends. Then you end up with post-traumatic stress syndrome. I dealt with many, many people in therapy with this. It's a therapeutic approach that's reasonably easy to deal with. You can get rid of people's traumas. There's ways to do this, and having them talk about the traumas is not the way to do it. It keeps them in the role, and so the issue with many of these actors, actresses, and so on, and some of their behavior can be attached to that. The goal here is know thyself. if you're going to be an actor, you damn well better know who you are starting out, or you're going to get really confused down the line.
Is that similar to when people have take hallucinogens? It's best to do it in a safe place with people who are experienced and will look after you if something bad happens, kind of thing. In the acting world, it's a similar thing. You're having this very deep experience, because when you're playing a role very intensely, it's actually a lot of work and it's a lot of strain on the brain. To remember who you are at the end of it actually sometimes takes a bit of work. So is that something that would be in the same realm as this, doing a trip of some kind? And bringing it back around, you mentioned taking on false characters or false characterizations through playing different roles, right? Could you bring that back around to Jesus and the Mushroom?
Well, in terms of, if I understand what you mean here, in terms of taking these substances, they are better taken within a ritual setting, because you don't know how someone is going to react to a certain substance, whether it's cannabis or mescaline or whatever it is. Some people aren't mescaline people. Some people aren't scopolamine people. And you have to trust the people that you're with, certainly. I mean, you can use these substances. Well, this is what supposedly our mythic hero, Jesus, I don't think he ever existed, but whoever was there, and you can read this in the literature, where these bishops would convert people by taking them on a trip. And they could do this very, very effectively, because on that trip, whatever they're experiencing, that can be directed. That's the point of the ritual. So you go out and you take a substance. There's no ritual connected to it. You bump into these images. They're all in your head anyway. And if you've got poor self-image, whatever it is, you're probably going to have a bad trip.
That happened to me once. I took mushrooms at a party and my girlfriend was there, and I started to kind of feel this really... I started to feel nothing. Like, you know how you can feel emotions at any given point, and I suddenly felt nothing. I felt no joy, no love, no hate, no fear, no anger. It was like I was turned into an emotionless robot for a moment, and it started to freak me out. And I went to my missus and I told her this, and she says, "Oh, baby, you're just having a bad trip." And I go, "Oh, so I am." And then a smile returned to my face, and it was all good. We'll be right back after the break.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone with God. Our needs are now different, and our aims. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone with God. Is gone.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a brand new world order on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And you can also check out the archives, because I am aware of time zone issues for some people, that you're at work or in some fashion you're still a slave or whatever. But when you come home, on the other hand, you can go to the Vinnie Eastwood Show archives. They're all up there. They're all free. Go for your life. Share them out somewhere. And I just found out yesterday that about an interview I did a year ago with an anti-New World Order MC named Jay Soley has just been put into a little Tupac documentary kind of thing. I thought that was pretty choice. Anyway, back to my very special guest, Dr. John Rush. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, back to my story about the bad trip at the party. I mean, what would your analysis be of that situation?
Well, let's look at what happens with, say, a soldier. A soldier gets into combat, experiences a lot of images. Now, what is given to people when you're interacting and walking around the world is simply information. What the person does is takes this information in through seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, and all that. And then an interpretation of that message occurs, and then an emotion is stuck on it for storage and retrieval. That's all emotions are for, really. They're for storage and retrieval of information. And so this is very similar. Post-trauma stress disorder is very similar to what someone taking a substance out of a ritual context, or even within a ritual context, often experiences. They experience information that's being generated in their own head, and then they put an interpretation on it. The interpretation they can't live with. That's the problem. Now, working in a psychiatric hospital back in the early 70s, about once a week, a teenager would be admitted taking, for example, morning glory seeds or Datura or whatever, and be right off the edge. It's very difficult to talk these people down, to get them to believe that they really didn't experience what they experienced. So this takes us back to the use of these substances within these cults. These people, when they took these substances, believed what they experienced. They believed that they were in contact with deities or demons, one or the other. And so this is why these groups all had rituals that went along with these. Now, in the original Jesus cults or Christ cults or whatever they were called back then, not everybody was welcome. This is an idea that's been put forth by the Catholic Church that, you know, Jesus had all kinds of people around him. Think about that for a moment. The Roman soldiers wouldn't allow more than a couple of people to gather anywhere. How would they control them? You hear of Jesus speaking to the multitudes of 5,000. That would never have happened. And the reason for that is that the Romans didn't have tear gas and machine guns. All they had was sticks and swords. They wouldn't have been able to control 5,000 people. So all that is storyline, and people have a tendency to believe it for one reason or another. At any rate, in these small groups, this is how it worked. In order to gain entrance and have communion with the God, you were offered a riddle, a parable. And if you could answer the parable, then it suggested that you could think. They didn't want people who couldn't think coming into these cults. If you could answer the riddle, then you could commune with God. There were three things that seemed to be propagated in these groups, from what I can understand in the literature. Of course, these are kind of secret societies, hard to know. But essentially three things that do come into Christianity, and that is know thyself, seek knowledge, and be a decent person. That's really all the original cults were about. They weren't interested in warfare or taking over or anything like that. They were very, very different from the Jewish tradition. But at any rate, bad trips, you're likely to have something like that outside of a ritual context.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean within the ritual context it's extremely unlikely or nigh on impossible?
Well, it can happen. It certainly happens. But to have somebody with you that you trust who can kind of talk you down and simply say to you, just having a bad trip, it's all happening in your head, you know. A person who cannot distinguish, for example, under the influence of alcohol, the difference between real and drug real is probably going to have a problem with all of these substances, maybe not cannabis, but maybe. But some of these, if you can't distinguish that on your own, stay away from these substances.
That's what I found as well. I've had many friends over the years taking substances for the first time and have very bad reactions to them. And they're like, no, bro, I'm going to stick with my beer. That's very, very good with me. I don't go out of control. I know how to distinguish myself from that. It's all good. I'm done.
Well, the other thing too is that going these substances that really take you to the inner level, like cannabis, for example, and you start putting thoughts together. Some people put thoughts together that they would love to suppress. So that's another area wherein people can have a bad trip as you start to recombine information. So an aspect of these cults, and I think an aspect of the consumption of the Eucharist or that which you're going to get to the other side, is to know yourself, the difference between the self that came in here before taking the substance, and then you afterwards. This would have been a very important aspect, I think, anyway, in terms of these particular cults. We don't have anything like organized, and I don't care what the scholars say out there. You can't trust what a lot of these people say anyway. I don't think we've got anything that resembles Christianity in any way, shape, or form until after about 312 of the current era. And this is when they start inventing all of these different gospels and everything. Gospel, by the way, does not mean somebody's book. The book is a metaphor for the mushroom. Gospel is God's spell. And that's what you get into when you take the substance. Revelation. Go ahead.
That's something that I always defined as being, you have to have a purpose to go on these experiences and to take a trip. I don't think that just sitting around by yourself with flashing lights and partying around is actually kind of the thing, because I find that whenever I'm in a block in my life, like a mental block, I feel like I'm in a rut. Instead of meditating or working on things and taking years and years and spending that on it, I'll simply have a hallucinogenic experience, and I will think very, very deeply and commune with my trusted friends, and I will get over invariably anything that was holding me back. And within a day or two afterwards, I've been supercharged in my life and my creativity, and it's as if I've removed barriers.
Yeah, I would agree with you that in our average everyday life, we play a number of roles, and these roles are all stereotyped, and every one of these roles is guided by some sort of a mythic frame of reference. You bump into situations where you need new information, as did our ancestors in their small communities. And when they needed new information, they didn't wait around for somebody to get sick or have a fever or have a near-death experience. The shaman took a substance, went to the other side, came up with new information, and came back and delivered it to the group. These substances allowed us to survive. There's a high survival value with these. Now, in this new book that's coming out that I'm editing, Jan Irving has a wonderful article in it. We get to see that the use of these substances had great survival value because they did allow us to go to another place. They did allow us to get past the world we get stuck in when we play our everyday roles, and to see information. It's well known that Watson and Crick, that DNA model came out of an LSD experience. So these are things that have been sort of withheld from the public in terms of the usefulness of these substances. But I think your initial statement, it's useful to have some sort of a purpose before you take the stuff. You know, what are you trying to do with this? Do you want new information? You want insights about yourself? You want insights about the world? And so you have a plan. That to me, other than that, by taking these things, you're just wasting it, I think. It becomes a waste of money and a waste of time. Mescaline, I've done mescaline. I grow San Pedro cacti. I've got them all over the property. I don't like mescaline. I don't have time for a 12-hour trip. I really don't. And if it's not a guided experience, you don't know if you're asleep, you're awake. It's not a pleasant thing. I'm not a mescaline person. Scopolamine's a little different. But again, for me, other than, say, cannabis, but all these other substances, you're better off taking them in a ritual setting. Because even our ancestors, even the tribal groups that are still around today that use these, when they give these substances to young people as a rite of passage, there's always somebody there guiding them. They just don't let them wander off into the woods. That would be a very, very dangerous thing to do.
Well, speaking of wandering off in the woods, I've seen this movie 300 recently, and in order to create the finest soldiers, they cast the child out into the wilderness for a time, and he's forced to fight. He's forced to survive, basically. You either return a man or you don't return at all.
And I was trying to think about this, relaying it to people in fields of research or activism, filmmaking, things like that. You actually really do have to go it alone sometimes in order to develop without anybody's help. Do you think that's the case as well, or is it so much better with guidance every time?
Oh, I don't think you need guidance every time. Let me clarify that. I don't think that that's really necessary, but you've got to understand what is going to happen in the experience and your ability to alter it, control it, use it. It's like daydreaming. That is a form of hypnosis.
Like lucid dreaming?
Or lucid dreaming. Or this is hypnosis, but it's difficult to guide it. That's the problem with it. But once you've had experience with it a few times, then you can, and then you can go it alone. But the real ingredient here is knowing the difference between drug real and real real. If you can't tell that, stay away from this stuff. I don't care how many times you take it, because you're going to get in trouble with it. More people get in trouble with alcohol because they cannot distinguish real real from drug real. They get in cars and they drive, they get in fights, and so on and so forth.
It's very important to stop yourself, and I think there's only been one time when I felt that I was definitely too drunk to drive, and I just got my mate to drive me home, and there you go. Even though I was like pouring out of myself and absolutely sick as a dog, I still had the capacity of thought and motor skills to give my keys to my sober friend and get into the passenger seat of my own car and have him drive me home. You know, just because you're out of it doesn't mean you should lose your head.
Yeah, and you can see how many people lose their head when they're out of it. And again, getting experience with these substances, although maybe not the best word for it, but getting some sort of idea as to what's going to happen, being able to anticipate the future. Is very important. I mean, we do a lot of things to try and do this, and with a mind-altering substance, it's no different.
I did take mescaline one time after I'd finished community service for being arrested at the age of 19, and I was wondering where to go in my life because I'd finished all the vineyard work was up for the summer. I wasn't enrolled in university, and I was wondering which direction to go in my life. And for the first 6 hours, it was just this very heavy, kind of slightly queasy body stone. But for the next 6 hours, it was like I could see through myself in time, if you know what I mean. Like I could commune with my future self and ask him questions. And he told me to go to Auckland University and to get a job in telesales, and those two experiences wound up basically giving me the skills and the basically the trauma going through those sorts of things and learning how your ideas don't matter in university and getting marked D for a brilliant essay because the marker didn't agree, you know, with my point of view that television was bad. All of these bad experiences, I think, actually gave me the skills and the experience that I need to do what I'm doing now, which I think is far more important.
Oh, I agree with you. It's a difficult world at best in terms of everyone's dealings with their everyday life. And these substances can be used to go in there and access information. Now, there is a theory out there that perhaps through the use of some of these substances, we actually communicate with our DNA. Whether this is correct or not, I don't know.
Well, the building blocks are the DNA of life. And if it gives you the ability to communicate with the building block of yourself, it actually seems almost an apt description for the experience in a lot of ways. We'll be right back with Dr. John Rush just after the break.
Nowhere to run to, baby. Nowhere to hide. Got nowhere to run to, baby.
fact. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live from the future. We're always a day ahead of the Americans, which makes this such a poignant news show. It's a shame I don't choose to read out articles most of the time because we're always spending 2 hours interviewing a guest. But that's going to be changing, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be having a new format starting next week-ish, where we will be doing about an hour of news, the first hour, and then have a very special guest popping in for the second hour. And we've also got a lot of other different videos and interviews that are done off-air that are uploaded directly to the YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media, all available for free. I hope you can check that out if you've got the time. Speaking of which, we also upload the normal shows to that, and I do the webcam. So for those of you who are actually watching on those, you can see my my T-shirt here. It's got the, you know, the WWF logo with the little panda? Well, I've got a WTF logo instead, with a little panda with a little raised eyebrow. And you go, what? You know, classic, classic. And I thought, and I don't know, forgive me if this is disrespectful, John, but I thought that that would be an appropriate T-shirt for this interview with you, because so many of the things that you discuss, that would be the response you'd get from most people. WTF?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My audience is kind of limited in terms of talking to people. Where I teach, I'm surrounded by liberals. And they don't want you talking about things. It's too disruptive to their neurons, I guess. You know, where I teach, and certainly within California and the school system, college, university, they promote critical thinking, but apparently only critical thinking in the areas they want you to engage in critical thinking.
When I came out of university, I said they didn't teach me critical thinking. They taught me how to be critical of people who think.
There you go. That's just about right. If you cannot stand back, everybody should be an anthropologist. You participate, you're with the fish in the fishbowl, swimming around, and you're participating, and you have to stand back and see what's actually going on and what people are saying. And by doing that, you can get a pretty good idea of what's kind of going on around you. Most people don't do that. They're sort of in a bubble with other people. And in that bubble with other people, that is the information that they use to run their lives. You got to go outside the bubble. You really have to go outside the bounds of the myth, and society doesn't like you doing that. And that's why we have all these restrictions on drugs. Now, I'm not advocating people take drugs. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that to have laws restricting these things, and there's a misunderstanding as to what these substances are, that's simply control, and I don't think it's really appropriate or healthy.
Well, the systems of control, I find, they're not actually designed to give people control. It's designed to control people.
Oh, absolutely. You have to control. And as we were talking at break, we can see, for example, with large societies, whether it's, we call it Britain or Germany or whatever, and these larger groups, United States, even Australia, they're made up of interlocking tribes of people. And these tribes have limited membership, and they have limited membership because we're a small group animal. We are biologically designed to operate in small groups. And in these small groups, there are three basic ideas. One is a will to life, and this is biologic. Anyone pushed against the wall will fight for their life. I mean, it's just part of us. The second thing is we engage sex and eat to maintain that life. And then we want to feel important in our group. And any political organization that does not recognize these three things and tries to control people with a central government, particularly when you've got millions of people, it'll fail. Because the people in the central government form their own little groups, and they look after their own needs and interests, which have nothing to do with the people back home that hired them. Because of our small group nature, all administration, use of money, and so on has to be local. It's the local people that know what's to be done, not people in Washington. These people are so out of touch with the world. Just look at it. Now, in order to have a sane society, you need quality information. Turn on NBC News. What do you get? I don't know what it is, but it certainly is not news. All of these organizations are like that. And so
doesn't NBC mean nothing but crap?
I watch them because my wife is a liberal, and so she has the Today Show on, so I get subjected to that. But that's okay. I don't mind watching that because I hear their point of view. And then I'll switch over to Fox News or Rush Limbaugh or Sullivan or whoever it is and try to pull in more information. I mean, they're all biased. I understand that. But here's the point. If a person doesn't have quality information, if the information is distorted or skewed in some way or other, an individual can't make a quality decision. The regime that runs the United States right now, I'm just flabbergasted with the amount of lies, deception, the extortion that went on with this health bill that Obama put through, the bribery that has gone on, the giving of money to unions as slush funds for political means so that money can be sent back to the politicians that are guaranteeing the money to them so that they can run their political campaigns. I mean, this is just a travesty. And when I'm surrounded by PhDs. And these people's heads are full of mush. It's hard to comprehend this. You've got, this person who's got this doctorate in psychology, or this person doctorate in sociology. They maybe know something about sociology or psychology, but they have no idea what's going on in the world around them. Why? Because they don't have access to quality information. Any society that tries to do what this regime is doing with information is going to fail. And if Obama gets elected again, I don't see the United States as being the United States anymore. He can invoke executive order. He can get people off the hook who are out there killing people, this Fast and Furious thing connected to the Defense Department, not the Defense Department, but the FBI and the DEA and all that. I mean, this is just a tragedy. And they did all that Fast and Furious in order to get our guns. That's the other thing. Why do we have guns? Why is that in our Constitution or the Bill of Rights? Why? Well, it's to protect us from the government and the police. I've been in countries, I've lived in countries where people could not defend themselves, and I saw what happened to these people. And there's no way in the world that I'm going to allow that to happen to me. Now, if other people want to hand their guns in, go ahead. I'm not. So we have some problems here. I mean, these are not just minor problems. This is not just one political party against another political party. This is the survival of a nation. And people just don't get it. Obama is the most incompetent individual I've ever encountered as a president. Either that or he has a Marxist. I think he's got a Marxist agenda. I think he wants to he hates the United States. And, to put somebody in power like that and for these liberals to think that he's good for the country, I think they're on drugs. That's the only thing I can say. Drugs without a
ritual. In a bad way. More like Xanax and Prozac and Starburst.
Yeah. I mean, you have to listen like Pelosi. I mean, this from a professional standpoint, I would have her institutionalized. Harry Reid.
It's funny you should mention Pelosi because apparently around Congress now, if they hear something that's BS, they say, oh, that's a lot of Pelosi.
Well, okay, that there you go. Even they're recognizing it. You know, after a while, even some of the liberals around there begin to understand that. And this is a good point, that when you start distorting information to the public, how does the individual know that the information coming, say, from the president to the Department of Defense or whatever is good information? How do they know? And so when you start distorting and lying, those people around you begin to wonder, well, is the information that I'm getting distorted in a lie? And so this is the other problem that we have in the government. Obama's machine is falling apart. And the only reason it has stayed together this long is because of the news media, which is, this is awful. I've got better words for it. I mean, one of them is on your T-shirt.
It's a cluster WTF.
Yes, then that's right.
Yeah. Have you ever signed a WTF trade deal, you know?
Yeah, well, you could get into those as well. It's really hard to fathom and understand some of the things that are going on. It's like, I'm sure that I don't think you can avoid following the news in the United States the way that's set up.
Because all the rest of the television channels in New Zealand are Americanized. About maybe 70% of our content is American.
Yeah, and that's a shame. I mean, you know, because they're setting it up, they're structuring all of this. It's really ridiculous. I mean, I could go on and on with this. Probably you're hearing my anger in here. It's more concern than anything else. I don't have very many more years to live. I'm an old man. But I think of my kids and my grandkids and what's going to happen to them. We've got a debt now that they're going to have to pay. And why do we have this debt? Because we have a president who does not understand Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics has nothing to do with free trade or anything else. Keynesian economics has to do with the government owning the means of production. And so Obama is going in this direction. Not only that, it appears that he's following a Nazi model. We've got the Volt, you know, the car, the GM car, and we have the Volkswagen. Do you see a connection?
Maybe there is. All right. Well, let's think about this, ladies and gentlemen. If you ever want to brutally dictate somebody into a socialist, communist frickin' manifesto, well, you've got to be funded by really, really nasty bankers at the end of the day, because nobody else really wants to accumulate everybody's assets and maintain total control except the bankers who have the money to make it up and do it. We'll be right back. Number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We try to put a little bit of a comedic spin on some of the quite frankly terrifying realities that we are going to have to be forced into accepting very, very soon if we want to actually do something about it. Okay? New World Order is coming for all of us. It's taking all of our countries over simultaneously. You've got all of these other things coming in, legislations to restrict your freedom of speech, free speech zones. I went to a protest here in Auckland and we were forbidden at a protest by a council worker with a yellow jacket from handing out any leaflets or flyers with any kind of information. We couldn't give people at a protest DVDs. Okay? Believe me, there is no safe or middle ground with this one. You are going to be forced to make a choice. And to do nothing is still making a choice. To do nothing is to support the agenda to destroy you, your family, your country, and humanity forever. Take that choice as seriously as I do and work as hard as people like John Rush do to research, to get the information out, to help people. as much as you can. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, speaking of helping people, you also have a lot of health background in this, and you mentioned in there Obama's recent passing of the Obamacare kind of thing. Has that been passed or what?
Well, it was passed. Obama got it passed because he used extortion techniques. He bribed people. As a matter of fact, I don't think any of the legislatures ever read the act. I mean, it's a couple thousand pages long. And Pelosi was saying, you know, you have to sign it before you can read it. Now, that's absolutely ridiculous. And so because of the way that this bill was put through, I'm not going to have anything to do with any of the Obamacare. If this thing stays the way it is, they can throw me in jail. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. By having something to do with it, you're allowing it to happen. And so what is important here is to rebel against this thing. And people are. This is the Tea Party that's out there now that is trying to do something. But let me ask you a question. You go to this meeting where people are trying to say something. You're handing out literature. Now, in New Zealand, have they taken away your guns?
We have very severe gun restriction in New Zealand. If you want anything that holds a clip of seven or more rounds, you need a safe, and it needs to be bolted to the wall and the floor, which means very few people who are renting will ever be able to own any kind of firearm, to put it bluntly. And in order to have a handgun, you need to do 12 appearances at a shooting range per year by mandate just to keep your license.
Yeah. Well, see,
and
that's
incredibly expensive. There's yearly fees for having your gun licenses in some cases, depending on the type of weaponry you have. It's illegal to pop a 30-round clip into a weapon in any other situation other than a firing range. If you are attacked in your home and you're tanker is not armed with a gun, you're not allowed to use your guns against them. Otherwise, you get done for manslaughter if you hurt or kill them.
Yeah. See, this is done for the benefit of the police and the government. The laws in the United States are the Bill of Rights telling us that we can have and bear arms is designed not for personal protection against the guy next door. This is, I use a baseball bat. No way to fire a gun in a house at night. You're going to blind yourself and you're probably going to shoot the neighbor. The gun is for protecting yourself from the government and the police. And the police will, because I've worked for the police for years. I worked with the Board of Corrections here in California for 20 years, rode with the police in many areas of the United States. And they will tell you that when they know that somebody is armed with a legitimate, concealed weapon permit, and the person has a gun, they communicate with that person very differently than if that person is unarmed. They're nicer, they're more polite, and that's the point. Anytime the government is afraid of the people, that's the win. When the people are afraid of the government, and that's what we're getting to be because we've become so dependent on them, that's a bad, bad situation. Because you just have to look at your history. People forget history, that is rapid fading. I don't know how that happens. Maybe it's too much sugar. At any rate, I want to come back to another subject here that we kind of approached before, and that is a statement made and has been capitalized by on Obama to show you how information is distorted. Ramsey said, maybe you're aware of this, Ramsey said when he was kind of off, the mic was still on and somebody taped it, that 40, he wasn't interested in the 44% of people because they were dependent on the government and they were, and so on and so forth. And that has been used to sort of demonize Romney, suggesting he doesn't care about half the United States. What he was actually saying is that 47% of the public in the United States, citizens in the United States, are in one way or another getting money from the government. Now, here's the dirty little secret. When you get to a point of about 60% of the people taking money from the government, it's all over. It's absolutely all over. The government controls everything at that point. And this is what Obama is going for. And I'm scared to death of this because the average person out there doesn't want to get money taken away, or they think money is going to be taken away. And so they tend to continue to vote in this direction. And what they're doing is they're throwing away their freedom. Anytime you're taking money from the government and you get to a certain point of taking so much, if you don't take that money, you're going to starve to death. And so this is the dependency, which is sick. It's a sick dependency. It's been created by the politicians. And this is what Romney was referring to. It's not that he doesn't like 47% of the population. What he's saying is that these people are dependent on the government. They're probably not going to vote for him. That's all he was saying. And this dependency leads to a sick society. You see, it comes back to our animal nature and our need to feel important in a group. If men aren't pursuing some sort of a career, if they're not doing something so they think that they are contributing, they get depressed. Why is that? Because in our small groups, everybody cooperated, and we've cooperated for a particular goal. Now, within all of this, we have two issues. Women represent nature, and men are in service to this nature. And so when men are out of work, deep inside, and the women are working, they get angry. They get frustrated for no other reason other than this biological need to do something. And so when you get people dependent on the government and they're sitting home eating bonbons, drinking beer or whatever, underneath all of that, they do feel pretty useless. And they justify it. They justify it by arguing against, really, getting out and doing something. They get so used to doing this and taking a check from the government. And so this anger then that they feel that's deep inside because they know there's something telling them genetically that they need to do something. This is what the politicians play with to get them to go out there and picket and so on and so forth. Talk about being totally controlled. Well, yeah, I'm getting Social Security, not very much, but I paid into it for 50 years or whatever it was. So I'm getting back what I already, and I'll never get it all back. I won't live that long to get it all back. But that's all the dependency that I will ever, ever accept from the government.
I was thinking this earlier as well, is that when you have nothing to catch you, you tend to want to try and catch yourself, right?
Right.
If there ain't no catch net out there for you, if there ain't no automatic $50 accommodation supplements is what we've got here in New Zealand, John. And so many people are, when they can't afford to pay a little bit more rent or something, instead of just thinking, you know what, how can I make more money? How can I expand my business? How can I make some cash on the side? How can I do all the, instead of thinking that, they go, oh, daddy, give us a handout. And they become dependent on it. And it actually stagnates them, and they wind up doing a job much, much too long because they're dependent on both that job's income and the government handout in order to make ends meet. If there was no government handout, they would have been forced through necessity to find a way that didn't currently occur to them to make ends meet. And I think that's what's really happening here. Is people are being held back by being held up.
Well, yeah. See, what you said it just right. You see, what happens with this dependency, the people say, oh, the poor person now has to go out and get a job. Well, oh, my gosh, that's awful. He's going to have to fend for himself. Where's he going to get the food? Well, here's what they did in China. In China, from 1948 up until very about 10 years ago, 11, 12 years ago, somewhere around in there, communism. And what would happen is you were ordered to go out to the field and work in the paddy field, for example. And most people went out to the field and they sat on the banks and didn't do a damn thing. A few people worked. Well, the government saw this after a while, after it went on for, 30 years or whatever it was. And they saw that this was terribly inefficient. They said, okay, no more handouts. What happened? These people found capitalism. When I was in Beijing, in China, we went all over China. This would be 2000, 2002. Amazing things happened. We would bump into people selling gloves and hats and screwdrivers, hammers, or whatever it is on the street. And that was out of necessity. The government wasn't going to pay for them anymore. And so they worked it out. Now, I would assume because the Chinese can do this, we could do this too. You bump into so many people who are unwilling to go out and do anything because the government is paying them as much as minimum wage. So what's the point? I hear this with professors over at the college. You know, they get laid off, you know, because of the break or whatever, and they jump right over and they get their 2 weeks or 4 weeks worth of free money from the government. And for them, it's cheaper to do that than to go out and work at a McDonald's or whatever for over the. And I can understand a professor not wanting to go out and do that. Certainly, it's kind of a demotion, but certainly they could do it.
What is the inherent problem here with the economy? I think that we have had so many inputs, so much social engineering, so much education to basically stamp out that independent entrepreneurial spirit over the last 100-odd years. And simultaneously, the people have become far, far more destitute, dumbed down, and impoverished over this period of time. And it seems almost as if it's a dying breed, like mystics getting wiped out by the Spanish or something.
Oh, yeah. This is a very different culture than what I grew up in. It's really hard to kind of fathom all of this in many ways as to what's going on here with all this dependency. But people are kind of like, it's like the statement that Obama made here a few weeks ago. You didn't build that, assuming, you know, trying to suggest that the average person is so dependent on everything else, he really didn't do it. But that statement is absolutely absurd. Let's say, for example, that I go out in the woods and I cut down a bunch of trees and I build a house. Am I to assume then that the trees built the house? This is essentially what he's saying. Obama is saying that whatever you do doesn't mean anything anyway. It is so demoralizing. It's a demoralizing idea. It takes away from the creativity of the individual. They don't want people thinking creatively anyway, because then they can think best all this mind stuff that the government is doing. They don't want you thinking. You're right. They're in this process of dumbing down. When I meet students who are functionally illiterate, I don't know what the hell they're teaching them in high school. They can't read. They can't write. What are they doing? And all this money that's thrown in there, these liberals throwing in all this money for this, that, and the other thing, and the education that they're getting doesn't really amount to anything. It doesn't educate them in those areas, particularly in critical thinking, as Jan Irving was saying in the interview we had with him. There's no critical thinking is what they want you to get into critical thinking with. In certain areas, but not in areas that might, you know, lead you into a really creative mood or whatever it might be. It really disturbing.
Can you deal with being disturbed if you're doing nothing about it? You have to distract yourself from it. And sure enough, in America, there is a vast array of distractions and entertainments. The most entertained population in the world, and conversely, the least informed.
Oh, yeah. I often wonder, where do people get this time to Twitter and do all this stuff? I don't Twitter. I don't even do. I can barely get through my emails because I've got three sources that I have to go to get them in the morning. It takes me a while to do that. But I've got other things to do rather than sit on my butt and Twitter to people and to read some of these silly things out there. It's like, you know, watching TV, watching people making clothes out of chocolate. I mean, what a dumbing down. Cupcake wars. I mean, this is all wonderful diversion, but what does it do for the individual? In the human brain, the human individual is so creative. All you have to do is look around to see this, and we don't promote it these days.
Well, that's because when you've got creativity, you can problem solve. Problem solving gives you power. You don't need somebody else to solve your problems. You can take responsibility and get them done. The problem is, when you empower people, it makes them impossible to control. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, live from the future. Yeah, giving some real up-to-date news and stuff. And now, I was talking over the break with my very special guest, John Rush, about tattooing. Turns out he's tattooed from neck to knees and knows quite about it. And you know who doesn't know nothing about tattoos and doesn't even have one? Me. So I'd like to allow you to expand on just what is tattooing? What does it mean? What do they represent? Is there something deeper, spiritual, or something going on here?
Well, an anthropologist goes about research in a very unique way. Anthropologists are participant observers. We're unlike psychologists who go out and give these silly tests which don't mean anything, or watching people behind a one-way mirror. That doesn't mean anything either. You have to really go out and participate in the group, and that's why I joined a cult. That's why I've been all over the world, different cultures. And this is how I got into tattooing. I was asked to write a book on it, and going in and getting a tattoo, well, that didn't make much sense to me because I needed to do research. And in order to do research and talk to people and the artists about this, you've got to have some kind of credibility. And so that touched off the neck to knees tattooing. As I mentioned earlier, it involved 400 hours of tattooing. You can do the math. It's about $50 an hour because this was going to be a long project. So I got a special deal. And the tattooing involves mythic themes from all over the world. You can go to my website and you can pull these up and you can see them as they were going on. In other words, the website and the tattooing was built over a series of a couple of years. As I would get the tattoo, I would write what the symbolic value of it and so on and so forth. there are a number of ways to have a spiritual experience. Certainly, you can have a near-death experience that can lead to traveling to the other side, so to speak. You can be ill, have fever, these types of liver damage from drinking too much alcohol, this type of thing. But there are essentially three ways in cultures that are designed for a spiritual experience. One is pain, the other is sex, and the other is drugs. Now, in Western culture, sex and drugs have been demonized in this area. And so what you're left with is pain, and they don't mind that. It's okay. Martyrdom is part and parcel of Judaism, Christian, Islam. As a matter of fact, that's the easiest way to get to God's place. So pain is okay. Now, I don't think a lot of them think very much of tattooing, but this is a way to have a spiritual experience. Now, tattooing, there's different tattoos, if you will. They have different meanings as you go around the world. Certainly in New Zealand, you've got all those wonderful tattoos that are hammered into your body. That is an art form that is, you really need to go to someone who really knows what they're doing, because if the needle goes down into the fat underneath your skin, then the ink spreads out and you get a mess. So these people have to really know what they're doing. Here in the West, and for the most part, they're using electric needles, if you will, to do this, and they only go down so far in the skin. Tattooing, there's so much to talk about with this. the inks become important. Let's deal with things that people generally don't read about. The inks that are used are very, very important. The original inks were probably carbon-based. They came from charcoal in fires, and so that leads us to believe that the ink itself had magical qualities to it because it was burnt. And fire is usually considered to be sort of a magical substance. And so they're putting a magical substance under your skin. Why would people tattoo in the first place? Well, from my experience, now the book that I'm taking this from is the book I wrote in 2005 called Spiritual Tattoo. This is through North Atlantic Books. One of the things here with tattooing and scarification in general is that nature does it to people anyway. Anyone who's lived any life at all, you fall down, you cut yourself, animals bite you, you get scratches or whatever, and so you have scars all over your body. I have a beard because I have scars all over my face. I've got scars all over myself from this. The tattoos actually covered up a lot of them. But nature does this. And I think through analogy, if you will, people began to put tattoos on their body to liken them to the animals that they were killing and eating. And for our ancient ancestors, they probably didn't see much of a distinction between themselves and the animals that they were killing and eating. They're all the same. This leads to identification with animals, and we still have this today with our football teams and baseball teams and so on and so forth. And so scarification, tattooing, probably is connected to this analogy of somehow being like the animals. We can see an evolution of this over time, people getting scarified or tattooed to protect themselves. In Laos, for example, oftentimes the tattooing is to protect themselves from bullets, which is understandable. Sailors would often have a cross on their arm.
Hold on a second. Back up. How does a tattoo protect you from bullets? Are they like Kevlar needles that they're tattooing you with or something?
Well, it's the symbol. Symbols are extremely powerful. I mean, look what symbols do. They allow us to build buildings and build cars and disrupt political organizations. I mean, symbols are the most powerful thing that was ever invented. And so these tattoos that they would put on in Cambodia and Laos, very much so in Cambodia, were more magical. And to get one of these tattoos, often they were put on by a Buddhist priest or whatever. These are similar to the bulletproof vests that the ghost dance religion people would wear that had symbols on them to protect them from the bullets from the U.S. Army. Of course, they didn't, but they thought they did. And so that's the important thing. The symbol gives you the idea that you can do this. One of the first symbols that we can identify that's connected to magical thinking is what's called an Acheulean hand axe, which was developed by the ancestor that we know that we're connected to, Homo erectus. And this comes up 1.7 million years ago. This Acheulean hand axe was used to crush bone and shave off pieces of meat of carcasses of animals they were scavenging. They weren't hunters. But you could use any kind of a piece of flint to. So this tool was more than it needed to be. And so what this tool stood for, and I mentioned this way back in 1996 in the clinical anthropology book, that these tools probably represented the teeth of the ancestors that they were killing and eating. And what it did was, symbolically, they had stole the power of the animal, and they could carry it around with them in their hand. So we can see this how potent this symbol would be and the arrogance that would cause. This Acheulean hand axe was probably the handgun of 1.5 million years ago. So tattooing is symbolic. It has magical qualities to it. I have tattoos on my body that represent my four kids. They are scarabs, which are a symbol of life and renewal. And other tattoos have other symbolic values to them. So when you go from culture to culture, the tattooing has a meaning that's connected to that particular culture. Shamans, for example, that we have found in these Scythian burials or Kurgan burials, both male and female, have very similar types of tattoos. And these tattoos happen to be in the likeness of magical beasts with beaks and this and that, which were probably protective in some sort of way. They also used color in their inks, blue, which I'm not so sure where they were getting the to die from. Really hard to know. But it could be from a woad plant. It's really hard to know where they were getting all this. At any rate, Sith, go ahead.
I was just thinking, in modern culture, have you heard of the tattoo known as the tramp stamp?
I've heard of trance dance in the Bali.
Okay. Let's say you've got a very young, fertile girl, and she's got a tattoo on the lower back.
The tramp stamp.
Yeah.
T-R-A-M-P, tramp.
Oh, yeah.
You're like a tramp. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've not heard of this.
Oh, I have heard of it. Yeah, the tramp stamp. Yeah, that's on the back, and that's for the guy to look at, I guess, while he's going at it. I don't know. Hard to say, but maybe it tells it. You see that a lot on the cowgirls here in California. These are the ladies that drive the pickup trucks and probably had horses when they were growing up and so on and so forth. So this was a mark of a lady who was a cowgirl.
Or a mark of a lady who's fond of a track and truck and trailer.
Yeah, yeah. Or sometimes they may be prostitutes. Usually it's just a lady who's a cowgirl and likes to get into the male world of trucks and horses and all that kind of stuff. But it's a tramp stamp. Yeah.
So, is there any real deeper meaning? I mean, do they actually know that they're going into this for that particular reason? Or are tattoos and where they're positioned and what kind of tattoos, are they sort of somebody's intuition in a way? Or are there real deep meanings and reasoning that should be going forth? Or is it a little bit of both?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but there's often something rather deep or profound. And these, none of my tattoos show. I could walk around with a t-shirt and shorts and you'd never know I had any tattoos. But you do find those tattoos that are a signal to the men, for example, to stay away, and that would be a butterfly. Butterflies are very prominent amongst the lesbian community. It's telling you that they have morphed or become something else for whatever reason. So that has a very deep meaning to it. And someone who's going to display that and tell people that that is their sexual preference, that has to have some really deep, significant meaning to it. Other types of tattoos that you find, for example, somebody's name or a rose with a knife stuck through it. I have a number of interpretations in the book there, this spiritual tattoo book. One of the ladies has a rose with a knife through it, and asking her what it means, and she says, "Well, I'm kind of sweet, but watch out, I'll stick you." And she will. She's a very caustic lady, and she uses humor like Roseanne Barr. And you wouldn't want to be the receiver of some of her wit. She's very clever, and that's what that means. But just looking at it, you might not get the point of it. So there's a deep meaning here, and many times the tattoo reveals it. Other times, it's hard to know what it means.
Mm. And you said, of course, that whole getting drunk and getting a tattoo in Vegas doesn't happen very often at all. So in general, there is something very highly either analytical or expressive or spiritual going on when people go and make a permanent mark on yourself. It's saying that this is me and I'm willing to have it on me permanently.
I thought you didn't know anything about tattooing.
No, I'm just figuring this out now.
Yeah, well, that's really what it is. That's really what it is. The getting drunk and going, I mean, that's like Kelsey Grammer in Up Periscope. You know, he goes in, gets drunk, and has, you know, welcome aboard on his penis. I have in some of my patients in the past, I had one gentleman who had a bumblebee on his penis, and his wife was extremely jealous of all this for anybody to actually see this. I guess she was shamed by it. I don't know. But it was what he called his stinger. So he had, great fun with that whole thing. I don't know how anybody would submit to having a tattoo put on their penis. But certainly people certainly do this. But you're right. There's a deeper meaning, and it's like the tattoos on my body. You probably wouldn't get what they meant unless I wrote them out. And of course, all that symbolism is there. On my butt, I have the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and I call it the ass text. You know, you've got the pyramid text and the Book of the Dead and the coffin text. Well, now this is the ass text. And it is the storyline of Osiris, really.
See, in order to understand the ass text, you've got to get the context.
That's right. The Book of the Dead, most people think, you know, from the mummy movies that have come out, it shows you how the brain has been turned to mush here. People think that the Book of the Dead is a black book with a lock on it. That's not what it is. The Book of the Dead begins with the pyramid texts going back to the Old Kingdom in Eunice's pyramid. And then that was too expensive to do. So when we get into the Middle Kingdom, anybody had access to the other side, the Field of Reeds. And so they started doing what are called coffin texts, where they would put the magic spells and all that to get through the underworld on the coffin. And then in the New Kingdom, they had the Book of the Dead, which was a papyrus scroll. The Book of Ani, who was a scribe, that papyrus scroll, I believe, is 18 inches wide and 90 feet long. So anybody who was going to have this done, have a scroll made of the Book of the Dead, had to be fairly wealthy to do this. So go ahead.
Well, I was just saying we're coming up to break. And when you're looking at movies, when you're looking at pop culture referencing, there's always a heck of a lot more going on, ladies and gentlemen, and there's a lot of disinformation. So if you want to define your life through movies, don't. We'll be right back after the break. Listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the final segment here. And I say this many times on the show because I think it's just classic. If you've ever seen the movie 2012 and it, he says, I thought we'd have more time. And that's how I always feel when you come to the end of 2 hours with a great guest. You just wish you had more time. So, John, we wanted to wrap up this particular interview. Firstly, I need you to plug your website. Secondly, we were going to talk about the Egyptians a little bit. And lastly, we're going to round it up with the whole 2012, December 21st, doomsday thing. So if you'd indulge me, go right ahead.
Okay. The website is www.clinicalanthropology.com. I also have a YouTube site where I speak with an alien, actually, a little bit of an interesting thing you might want to get into. It's Osiris, the number 12 gates. Osiris is spelled with a capital O. All the rest are small numbers. Let me mention my publications just to get a plug in here. If you go to Amazon and just type in John A. Rush, a bunch of books will come up. Spiritual Tattoo is one. The 12 Gates is another. The third book would be Failed God, Fractured Myth in a Fragile World. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam hate me. I think I'm at the top of the do not read list in the Catholic Church with that book. And then finally, the Mushroom and Christian Art, which just came out in 2011, where you can get to see all the mushrooms in the Christian art. And the question is, why the hell are they there? Going from this, let's go back to the Egyptian thing for a moment. In ancient Egypt, there's a very interesting story about Osiris. And if you understand that myth, you understand a great deal about Egyptian religious traditions. There are so many things that come out of ancient Egypt that come into Christianity and Judaism and so on. But there's one thing that's very important to us here, and that is the number 72. The number 72 is connected to the number of attendants who come out once Osiris is put into a coffin that exactly fits him. This is sort of the glass slipper thing. And they wrap iron bands around this and they drown him. I won't tell you the whole story because we don't have enough time, but they drown Osiris in the Nile. Those 72 attendants that come out is a connection to what's called precession. Or if you look up into the heavens, to make this simple, if you look up into the heavens and if you wait 72 years, the zodiac will move 1 degree of arc. If you multiply 72 times 360, you come up with a number 25,920. That is the grand cycle, if you will. So as you look up in the heavens, if you wait 25,920 years, it'll come back to where it is. All the cultures that I've studied so far, advanced cultures anyway, Mayan, Aztec, Hinduism, ancient Egypt, Europe, and so on, they have this number 72. So they all were aware of this. So what the hell does it mean? Well, let's go to the date, December 21st, 2012, which according to the Mayan calendar is the end of the fifth time period for them. Now, their time periods are actually geared to a date that I believe is, I may have this a little off, it's 3125 BC. 3125 BC is a very important time period because it represents an extinction on the Earth. This extinction happened when solar flares were very, very active on the sun, and we moved through a galactic cloud, and when we did that, meteors hit. The solar flares changed the weather. Civilizations crashed all over the place. And so that's the time period. And so their time periods are geared to, if you take that time period and you move it up to December 21st, 2012, you can see that time period is geared to the next cycle. And so they've got this measured according to about a 5,125 year cycle. So if you go from December 21st, 2012 back to 3,125, that's the cycle they're talking about. This is the fifth era, fifth time period. And so what they're saying is that we're probably going to go through that galactic cloud again, and we've started into it. Now we can see these extinctions going right back to 9600 BC. When we have a civilization in Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey, was an advanced civilization which the academics have not been able to accommodate into our history or prehistory for whatever reason. They had monumental architecture, they had calendar, they had writing, they had everything. That got destroyed. We have another one that occurs a few thousand years after that, then another one at 5600 B.C., 3200 BC, 2300 BC. And so I think what they're saying is that, according to their calculation, we would be going through that galactic cloud again. And you know, that appears to be what's happening. This has been recognized since the 1950s. There's a lot of literature on that. And so maybe we are going into a period where civilizations are going to crash. We've got drought in the United States. Other things are happening. This isn't global warming in the sense of Al Gore, who has, that guy's a crook. He gets the Nobel Peace Prize is worth nothing as far as I'm concerned. Giving one to Obama and to Al Gore, the Nobel Peace Prize, you might as well go down and buy a Cupid doll, as far as I'm concerned. The global warming that we're experiencing, well, there may be something to it in terms of, the Industrial Revolution, but this is being caused by solar flares and a lot of extra information that's coming into the atmosphere of the Earth, and not specifically sinful humans. When anytime they talk about global warming, they talk about carbon credits, you know you're into politics and economics. It's as simple as that. If they're really concerned about the Earth, they wouldn't get into that type of thing at all. This is just politics. And these people, should be run out of town on a rail. So the end of the fifth era, it is the end of a time period, but it may be a signal that we're perhaps going into this galactic cloud. I mean, it's happened before. We can see the remnants of this in the ice cores in Iceland. We can see them on Mount Kilimanjaro, and we can see that these particles are coming from outside of the Earth, and they're not being created inside. A lot of these aren't being created inside by burning coal and all the rest of that. So we're into a bad situation now. I don't know what to think of it, but that's the December 21st, 2012 business, the end of the fifth time period in the Mayan calendar system and the beginning of a new one.
Was that a part of the fear paradigm, I think, that is trying to be sort of sidelined a bit, do you think? Or rather, using the fear paradigm of, oh, my God, it's the end of the world, tidal waves and all that sort of stuff, to make people stand down to the New World Order. Who cares about it, you know, as we're all going to die anyway?
Yeah, I think it probably could go either way. That certainly could be used either way. The sad thing about this is all the disinformation that we've been handed and all these quote-unquote academic scientists who have gotten on board with this global warming thing, when the evidence for it in terms of sinful humans causing it anyway it isn't very convincing. It really isn't. Termites put out more carbon dioxide than humans do. There's more carbon. And then we have methane coming out of the oceans that contribute to that. My God, in 2006, we had a forest fire up the hill here on Highway 50. And that put out more garbage in the atmosphere than all the cars in California could put out in a year. And so, you know, you've got to get into critical thinking here. You can't allow these politicians and academics to tell you the truth, because I don't think they know what it is themselves. You've got to stay open. You've got to stay open to other possibilities. It's like medicine. You've got to be your own doctor. You can't trust the medical community because they're not based on a wellness model. They're based on an illness model, a fixed model, a suppression of symptoms model. And it's not a healthy model. In order to fix the medical system, we've got to get into preventative medicine, but you can't have the government instituting it. This has to be something that the individual has to know about in terms of taking care of themselves. First of all, we don't get quality information there. And once you know about it, you can either implement it or not. It's up to you. But don't rely on the medical community to fix you up. You got to fix up yourself.
That's what personal responsibility is all about. Oh, I don't know how to fix this. Let's figure it out. How does this work? Well, let's take it apart. Okay. Let's have a look at it from all these different angles. Let's verify these kind of things. Can I fix it? Yes, I can. So I fix it. Did I need any help? No? Nobody's around? Oh, my God. Have you ever heard that that story about, is it the little brown hen or the little red hen? When she's going around everybody asking them for a little bit of a hand to help make some bread, right? And at the end of it, everybody's like, no, I can't be bothered making bread. But as soon as she's made it, and she had to make it all on her own, all the other animals started coming out and going, it's fresh bread. Hey, can we have some? She goes, no, you didn't help at all.
Well, this is the ant and the grasshopper. I mean, it's the same story. All you got to do is read Aesop's fables and you'll get the morality that you should have. Be a decent person, seek knowledge, know yourself. And people don't know themselves. They don't know how gullible they are. I have a couple of segments on my YouTube site on gullibility and why people are so damn gullible. Now, my YouTube's not very sophisticated, but I hopefully get the message across. At any rate, we're in trouble with this. People got to learn to start thinking for themselves. They need emotional responsibility. To believe people give you emotions is one of the greatest traps in the world, throws you in jail because everybody does it to you. See, if you believe that people give you emotions, then whatever you do is justified because they started it. If you believe someone made you angry, you can beat them up and say, oh, they started it. Or you believe that someone has offended Muhammad, there you go.
That's right. Thank you, John. Dark him.